Alrighty, hello everyone. Welcome back to the Everything is Tying podcast. My name is Jeremy.
My name is Ruby.
And today we have an episode about something.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually.
Yeah, you just wait.
We just really brainstormed a lot about this, you know?
Yeah.
And we came up with something we both agree on, which is rare, actually.
Right. So Ruby said to me right before, like, we have to do an episode solely about Peppa Pig and JJ the Jet Plane. I thought, oh my gosh, Ruby, this visionary idea that you've had all this time that you've been harboring.
I hate that you are immediately trying to, you know, blame me for this topic. First off, we're not talking about Peppa Pig or JJ. Mm. I feel like people who listen to our podcast have heard enough about them. You know, just the hold that Peppa Pig and JJ has had over Jeremy has been insane.
I was commending you for your innovative thoughts and ideas. Not blaming.
I'm sorry. When has that ever been true in our friendship? When has Jeremy ever been like, yeah, okay, sure.
All the time.
I definitely got a birthday card from him 1 year being like, I commend you for your innovative thoughts, Ruby.
Yeah, I remember when I gave that to you and you cried with joy. It was really impactful.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was for my 18th birthday. I was really weeping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A loss of, you know, your youth and this...
Some wild claims tonight.
It is wild, though. I don't know if we talked about it, but I did have someone tell me recently that they said that the peak, this is a female friend that I have, who talked about how, like, peak age is like early 20s.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, I've heard that claim for both, but I've heard it like more like with women, it's like your 20s, especially your early 20s, are like your prime. And then 30 is like cut off, quote unquote, cut off. This like,
oh, like you become Silas Marner when you become 30? Like, what is the claim?
No one's going to get that reference because only you read the book.
I, you know what? Other people should read that book.
Silas Marner? I don't even remember what it's about. I know he was a hermit, but then like also he got money in the end.
He harbored gold, I think. It's been a long time since I've read it. That just made me think of that. I don't enjoy the claim that like people have a optimal period of time, which is their peak or whatever.
No, but I mean, like, I've heard that a lot also. That like once you, at least for like women, once you hit 30, it's like a downhill type of thing.
Then what is it for men?
It's like men, like, quote unquote, age better. And so therefore, like I think the whole claim is that like men can still be like earning and gaining success, quote unquote, but like women's only, like, the people who claim this are like women's like only value is in their youthfulness. Therefore, that type of argument.
Oh,
so because men aren't as prided on youthfulness as women are, it's like a thing where it's like, well, okay, if you're a woman, then that's like the optimal time to, you know, get married or et cetera, et cetera.
Oof.
I know you love that take. Could you?
I don't love that take. The only thing I can think that'd be tied with is, other than misogyny, is like the idea of bearing children, I guess, or ease of bearing children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I'm not the right person to ask about children. We've established that in this podcast.
Well, you're not going to have like a child in the next 5 years or so. And then
I can't describe to you the existential crisis you just caused me by making me think about having a child in the next 5 years.
Well, I mean, the next 5 years, you know, we're 30. So are you going to be a dad by 30?
No, I can't imagine.
I can't imagine the thought of like going to our like class reunion and like more than half of our class being parents.
I see people getting married at a young age. And I look at it in a bit of awe in the sense that they can be even like younger than I am, right? Say early 20s. They can be in their teens. And in a way, be it like a later quote unquote life stage as you, which is a very strange thing to witness. Like,
yeah.
Like seeing 20-year-olds that have like multiple children. In a way, I'm like, well, good for you. Like, because the idea of having like one child mostly financially stresses me out, but also just like the responsibility of caring for like a small human seems like a lot. That's just me though. Maybe you're like ready to have all the babies before 30.
So does it freak you out to like have a child or more than it freaks you out to have a spouse?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
I'm just wondering. Yeah. I mean, I can see why that would be like considerably more. So can you see yourself married in the next 5 years?
More likely than having a kid.
Like, what percentage do you think, like, if you're married in the next 5 years, like, what percentage do you think that is then? Like, 50% chance?
No. 20, maybe. Okay. You're also saying, like, marriage before 30, which means you're engaged. Like, I'm not going to marry somebody in, like, 6 months. I'm not doing it.
No, but in 5 years?
Yeah, my point is, like, if you're married by 30, I'd probably have to meet somebody by 28.
Oh, okay. So then you would just marry them after 2 years.
That, I can't imagine anything quicker than that.
So 2 years is not too quick for you. You'd be like, okay, this is fine.
I don't think so.
So what type of person do you want to marry? Have you already thought about that?
I have not, because like, that gives me anxiety. No.
No, like what type of person, like, okay, I'm just going to rephrase the question. Then you're going to be like, Ruby, why are you just rephrasing the same question?
New question. When you are married, what kind of person is it?
It would be like the best game show host. The person asked, can you rephrase the question? And I'm like, okay, I got you.
No. What you really need to do is you need to be running the spelling bees. But these children were asking you for any hint at all. And you're being like, let me rephrase the same sentence the same way again.
Those poor kids. If I was on like the national spelling bee.
What is the country of origin? Not here.
Can you give me another definition? Well, it's not there.
Right. What is the definition of that word? Well, it's different than the definition of guava. It's not guava. So.
Exactly. And then it'd be me being like, well, it's not a fruit. Or is it? Actually, I don't know. I'm like, and then Jeremy would just watch it just to make fun of me.
Oh, videotape it. You'd be a viral sensation.
Right. It's like, do you want to watch the video of Ruby just giving people definitions at the spelling bee? How did she get this job? Was there no voting process?
And the word is boa constrictor. Can you use it in a sentence? A boa constrictor is not a fruit.
I hope that helps.
Country of origin? You know? Well, it's a place that has fruit.
It's like, can you be more specific? It's like, well. No, actually. Because I don't know where it is.
Maybe guava.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm like, maybe it's a vegetable, maybe it's not.
Yeah. Maybe it's a vegetable, maybe it's marriage. Yeah. That's what I learned from VeggieTales was matrimony. If VeggieTales was good for anything, it was good for pushing the heteronormative narrative. We applaud VeggieTales.
I didn't watch VeggieTales when I was younger. So when I was introduced to VeggieTales later on in life, I didn't understand the appeal of singing vegetables. I still don't, quite frankly. But, you know, I'm not really sure I can say that. I mean, I can say that, but at the same time, you know, I'm watching something like SpongeBob, which is basically just a singing sponge. But yeah. SpongeBob had more bops. I'm willing to say that.
I don't know. VeggieTales had a good theme song, I will say.
Interesting. Maybe we should do a cover of their, like, greatest hits.
No.
I would love that. Actually, can I ask that for my birthday next year?
You can ask.
Exactly. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write to Jeremy and just beg that that's my birthday gift.
Wow. You're going to have that in writing.
I think that would be great, great material from you.
I really love that your aspiration as an adult is to be indoctrinated by veggies.
Is that what they do?
There's some fun musical numbers, some fun episodes, but it is very much like Bible time, but with asparagus. I don't know. But do you see yourself being married in 5 years?
That's an interesting question.
Is it? Let me rephrase it. When the marriage doth appear, do you see it in the years of five?
Is that how I sound when I rephrase questions to you?
Is it fruit?
Just I go from like normal to just no for your Shakespeare. Like what is the...
I don't know. Marriage, the idea of getting married in 5 years presents no anxiety to you?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, I would say it does.
What about it gives you anxiety?
Oh, so I'm not amazing at like vetting people. So, you know, that's a little bit concerning.
Okay.
But I have gotten better at it. So I think that's why it's giving me less anxiety now. Because I've gotten better at it.
Yeah. Where's the evidence and proof for the claim?
I have the evidence. I am the proof.
Oh, you know. You are the proof.
I am the proof. So,
gosh, you are the way, the truth, and the life.
For sure.
Nobody comes to the marriage except through her.
Me as somebody's lawyer, me in court. How do you know you didn't do it? I'm like, I am the evidence. Like,
Exhibit A points to self.
God.
Interesting.
No, I have gotten better at vetting people, and you know, I've gotten significantly better.
Well, it's a very strong claim. You're like, I've gotten significantly better.
Significantly, like very much to the point where it's like, okay, you know how I was previously? I don't know why I'm actually acting like you don't know me.
Yeah, the audience probably needs more than just like, you know how I was previously?
So like previously. Okay, yeah, yeah. So the audience needs a rundown on this, right? So previously, I have not been, you know, the greatest person that just vets people really well, as Jeremy would say. Meaning that like, I don't really see red flags.
No.
Occasionally, I don't see red flags. Like that's how I would describe my prior self.
Occasionally?
Yeah. Like occasionally I would have the tendency to maybe just like overlook minor red flags. And I just didn't realize it, you know? And then I would talk to Jeremy and he would be like, this seems like a red flag. And I would be like, oh, interesting.
So now you see them but ignore them.
No, now I see them and I do something about them. As previously I did not see them, nor did I do anything about them. Mm. And you know, it was a lot. Because I just could not see any of the red flags. And it was just like, Ruby, what are you doing? I think Jeremy had told me that multiple times.
I have, yeah.
And now, you know, I don't need anybody's help to see them. And I am just thriving. Don't we love that for me? I love that for me.
I love that story, that tale.
Right. It's like, I love that fictional narrative, Ruby.
I didn't know we were doing a narrative episode.
Shut up. I mean, you see red flags a lot easier than I do, so that's good for you. But
I mean, it's good and bad in that there are definitely times when I meet somebody initially and I see what are probably more minor red flags. And I just am like, I don't have the bandwidth to deal with this. And then depending on how much scrutiny you have for other humans, you may be keeping people out of your life that could be good in the long run. I don't know.
But good for you, Jeremy. I'm so glad that you're thriving with that.
I didn't say that. You know? I didn't say thriving.
Jeremy's making friends left and right.
This narrative again.
I like to think that Jeremy's a social butterfly. I really get a lot of amusement out of that.
Yeah, when have I ever been a social butterfly?
I've seen you pretend to be one. It doesn't count as you being one.
No.
But like, you know, profile Jeremy is pretty social when he wants to be.
I can fake it.
That's what I'm saying. You can fake it. Doesn't mean you're actually a social butterfly.
So am I a fake butterfly or am I a real butterfly?
You're a fake butterfly. So, you know, we're both fakes.
Wow. Well, Ruby, I'm going to give you a compliment. You're a real caterpillar.
This friendship, what even is that? Like, thank you. Honestly, that's what he wrote to me on the stupid little Valentine's Day cards, probably in middle school. He's like, you're a real caterpillar, Ruby. Thanks.
I'm just really giving you the emotional support that you need.
So here's a good question. So in this season of your life, right? Like, can you let me talk? Can you let me ask?
That just made it sound like I was dying. In this final season of your life.
I said in this season of your life. I didn't say final.
Upon death's door, Jeremy.
So are there any like particular life lessons that you have realized up to now where you're like, oh, this is important for people who are in their 20s to know about friendships or relationships, etc.?
Oof.
Like how's that going for you? Like making friends as an adult?
I mean, we talked about some, but I mean, it gets more difficult when you're all adults and you're not in a structured environment where you take the same classes every day. I would argue though, it's even when you get to college, it's hard.
It just gets continually harder. But have you like what have you learned about yourself in terms of people you like to make friends with? Are there like certain patterns that you see in people where you're like, okay, these people have a lot of these same traits and I really like that in friends and I bond well? Because I feel like in your 20s, you figure out who you bond well, really well with. Like, what does that share trait among your friends right now?
Mainly dry and sarcastic sense of humor. I think that's the common thread amongst all of them. I find it more difficult to establish any sort of connection if there isn't a shared sense of humor.
If there's not a friendship, I actually don't feel connected to that. That's a hot take.
You won't believe it. Like, because I am a fake butterfly, when I try to talk to some of the real butterflies, I don't have a real connection with them. And they kicked me out of the butterfly palace. And then I had to go hang out with Ruby, who's like a real caterpillar, which is pretty cool, you know?
I hate you. Thank you for bringing me down. Jeremy on a reality show, like, I'm not a real boy.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Right. I'm going to go hang out with Ruby over there because she's also fake. Wow. So, like, no, I understand what you're saying, though. Like, I know sense of humor is like really important to you. You know, actually, like, it's interesting when I hear people who, like, that's not like a bonding thing for them.
I don't get it.
Yeah, I've been having like this existential crisis of like, what exactly is my humor, sense of humor, right? Because some people have been like, oh yeah, I don't really like dark humor. And they're like my friends. And I'm like, you don't like dark humor? But I'm like, they just don't think I like dark humor. Like, I don't know. Really? It's just very much like, do I like dark humor? Or do I not like dark humor? That's my question. I don't know the answer to that.
I would say you do. Either that or you're just like bringing out all the dark humor for me and keeping all the light humor for other people.
What is light humor?
I don't know. Knock knock jokes.
Ew. You think like, I have like an arsenal of knock knock jokes?
Limericks, knock knock jokes, puns.
That, yeah. You know, I actually don't have a dark sense of humor. It is really just all knock knock jokes and puns.
Yeah. That's really makes you a good caterpillar.
Right. That's all it really takes, actually. And what makes Jeremy a fake butterfly is his dark sense of humor. I mean, I don't know. Humor is important.
I think so. What about you? What have you noticed as a common thing amongst all of your friends?
It's not humor, for sure.
Interesting.
A lot of my friends do not at all share the same sense of humor as me. It's just like this kind of subsection that I can't... Like, when I talk to them, it's like we'll have really deep conversations. It just won't be... It won't have that humor aspect to it. So, like, how we talk, we're like... Mm. We kind of constantly go off on tangents.
Yep.
It's not at all like that. So more of the conversation is just very deep conversations about things. I don't really know how connected a person is to their humor. Like, I don't know if like a humor is a subsection of a person or if it's like a reflection of who that person is. Because if like someone's like, oh, I don't like dark humor, then I'm like, I don't really know how to take that. Because I think I can have a pretty dark sense of humor.
You can, yeah.
And I enjoy that type of humor. Yeah. But it's like... Yeah, I don't really know.
I mean, I think you can be close with different people in different ways and not necessarily share all parts of your life or who you are.
I would agree with that. And I don't think humor is much of a bonding thing for me. I thought it was, and I still go back and forth on it. I just think I feel close to people in different ways. You know, when we talk about deep conversations, we'll have like two other conversations on something not serious. And I love that for us. It's great. But it's amusing because the way we cope with like very serious things is we'll make it a joke out of it. Right. And yeah. I think that's so amusing because it's like all this like very terrible things. And then it'll just be reduced to like one inside joke that we'll carry with us, like torch through.
I think it's important to cut the tension for me.
Why? Like it just feels awkward to you or just like you feel like this is too getting to know somebody too much, like you're crossing a line.
I just think it's taxing for me to be in a conversation where it's just like a dearth of humor. I can have serious conversations and that's fine. But at a certain point, it almost feels like bloodletting. I like there to be ebbs and flows in a conversation.
I don't think I need that. Like, I'm completely fine having just like a super deep conversation with somebody and not having any comedic relief whatsoever. Because a lot of times even my friends, like recently I was telling them something and I was texting them and like I threw in like LOLs or whatever. Or like this has happened in person. Or like I was talking to somebody about something. And they were like, why are you laughing about this? Or like even over text recently, I was talking to somebody about something, like, why are you laughing about this? Like this is super serious. Like why are you laughing? Like they really don't enjoy the fact that like I take like serious things that are happening in my life and then I just make like jokes about them. Or I'll be like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if this happened based off of like this really terrible thing that happened? And they just are like, they look at me very concerned. They're just like, why are you laughing? This is not a laughing matter. And I'm just like, I don't know. Oof. I just throw in an LOL on it. It's great.
No, I mean, humor is a really effective coping mechanism and can be a very healthy coping mechanism.
It really is. And like, I don't think they understand. And I tried to explain it to them. I'm like, there has to be some kind of comedic thing if something bad's happening in my life. And they're just like, but it's serious. I'm like, yeah, but like, can't we just laugh about it? It's interesting because my friends whose coping mechanism is humor, it's like there's that banter where it's like I'll make a joke and then they'll make a joke off of my joke and that's not there in these kind of like friendships.
Yeah. I imagine it's a give and take because it can also be like if there's a really good bit that's happening in the middle of a serious conversation, it's hard to not continue with the bit. So there is that.
I don't know. Sometimes it is just really funny to have just like a plethora, slew of just jokes about it.
Sometimes you just have to laugh without the ability to find the humor or the lighthearted nature in things that are tough. I would find living very difficult.
I don't know. It's just weird. It's an interesting coping mechanism to have, I think.
Yeah. I forgot who said it, but it's like you could either cry or laugh, and I prefer to laugh. So.
To me, crying is exhausting. And I've said this in previous episodes when people are like, oh yeah, you should just cry about it and feel better. That's not a thing for me. I can laugh about it and feel better. I certainly have. But like crying and feeling better is not my experience.
Yeah,
Whereas like some people that is, and that's great for them.
no, that's totally fair. One sort of dark thing, quote unquote, that we were able to laugh through was our movie for the week, which is called The Vampire Happening, which is a German film from the 1970s, a comedy, not a strict drama. We can say that for sure. And I don't even know where to jump into this.
This is like Lindsay Lohan's Parent Trap if one of the twins was a vampire and they were also like adults.
Yeah, but it's also a princess switch in a way.
Yeah, I couldn't tell which one it's more relatable to. Is it Parent Trap or Princess Switch? Because they're not really
Well,
switching places knowingly.
I would say it's not the Parent Trap because one of them is the grandmother of the other one. So definitely not the Parent Trap.
No, but in the sense that they look the same, like they look identical and they keep like switching places, but also not knowingly because they're just pretending to be the other person because one of them doesn't even know the other one exists. Jeremy, why don't you explain it to them?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so the movie opens, it's another castle. So I'm like, oh my gosh, is this somewhere that Vincent Price has been? I'm looking around to see if it is the Vincent Price lair from one of the many movies of which he has been dressed up in latex in a castle, causing havoc. It is not, though. But it opens with we see this, who is apparently famous woman, come to this castle. And she is dressed like at the beginning of the Dr. Goldfoot
Why are you
film.
making this reference as if everybody is going to understand what the beginning of a Dr. Goldfoot film is like?
Oh my gosh. Okay, fine. Well, I think the beginning of Dr. Goldfoot is iconic. And if you've been to the podcast, you've heard Dr. Goldfoot reviews, but fine. She's dressed like Pink Panther from the ankle up in a large trench coat, but then is wearing like Judy Jetson boots and has what I'm assuming is some sort of aggressive wig. There are lots of unfortunate wig choices in this movie. And she walks into this big castle that apparently she is the heir to because her grandmother used to run it. And then they're all vampires, which we later find out, and they're all in caskets in the house. It's unclear why only the grandmother came back to life. Also, I was gonna bring this up, but they're like six different coffins, and only one person rose from the dead to cause havoc. She meets John?
How could you not remember his name?
George.
This was your favorite character.
John
Wow.
Jingleheimer
I'm
Schmidt.
judging.
His name is my name too. No.
It's a biblical name.
Job?
Yes, Jeremy. His name is Job.
I don't remember what his name is. What is his name? Fill us in.
His name is Joseph.
I was close. But he is the main comedic element of the film, sort of. But he's also the victim of the film.
He's not a victim.
I mean, he's gaslit the whole time.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I thought you meant the people who got turned into actual vampires, but.
No. I low-key didn't care when people were turned into vampires. I was more concerned about the emotional turmoil that he was going through.
Jeremy saw a lot of himself in Joseph, apparently. Yeah, no, this guy was gaslit the whole film because it's about, like, why don't you give him the SparkNotes version?
Okay, Grandma Lindsay Lohan is a vampire from the past who is dead but is somehow arisen. I'm forgetting how. Real life Lindsay Lohan is Pink Panther Judy Jetson woman who is famous. She's coming back and is like running around the town, going to parties, doing fun things with vampires, apparently. That's most of the movie. And then it's just like shenanigans that are happening to where the grandmother keeps rising from the grave, going and turning people into vampires because she needs blood. And they think that it's the granddaughter because they're identical. The climax is a large vampire party. This is all happening in Transylvania, too, even though I think it's a German film. And it ends with a scene of the sun coming up. But then I don't understand, because my understanding of vampires, and you're a big Twilight fan, so maybe you can correct me on this, is that they, most vampires, I thought, couldn't be in the sunlight. I thought, like, that was a thing that they shouldn't do.
They can't. That's why, like, at the end of the movie, when they're, like, running out of the castle, they're all freaking out because the sun's coming up and they're all gonna die.
But the sun is out and they're just, like, getting in cars to drive home. Like, the sun would still, they'd still be impacted by the sun, right?
It wasn't,
like,
sunrise. It's in the middle of the night.
But they all had to drive home or walk home and the sun was already up.
Yeah.
How did they not all die instantaneously? How were they driving motor vehicles home?
I don't know. I have no clue. Wouldn't it have been a better plan to stay in the building?
That's what I'm saying. Just all the windows, just cover them up. But no, we're going to run out of the building and drive home?
Plot holes.
I didn't have many plot holes until the end. And I found the ending very confusing because I thought I understood what vampires were. And they're like, no, you don't. Apparently they are sunlight scampering vampires.
They do not glitter in the sunlight.
They don't. Yeah, thank God. That's the spark notes, though. Was there any substantive plot points that I missed?
I mean, not really. It's weird at the end because they send the vampire to Hollywood. That's their solution. And they basically, like, the girl is just, like she's fine. And she gets to, like, stay with Joseph and this teacher that she's dating. And so, like...
Oh, yeah.
But the solution of sending the vampire to Hollywood, that also didn't make any sense, though.
It didn't,
because, like, they thought they were sending the friend off to Hollywood, but they just sent the vampire off to Hollywood. It was, I don't really know what happened at the end. All I know is that the vampire ended up in Hollywood and that the real girl ended up fine and in Transylvania.
Yeah, I was fine until I looked at the clock and I'm like, there are 7 minutes left of this movie and we're still at the party.
It was a too passive an ending.
Yeah. They really could have just had the sunlight come up and everybody just vanish. That would have worked.
That would have been kind of a cool ending.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't have the budget for the CGI or whatever for it.
Right. Exactly. It's just strange because, like, this whole time, this girl does not know her grandmother, who is a vampire, is risen from the dead. And then when she finally confronts this person who everybody's been talking, well, not everybody, Joseph has been talking about, it's like they have like a 10-minute conversation and they're cool with each other because they're family. And so it's like, well, then what was the conflict? Like, what, like, I don't know what we're doing here. So.
It was a very fun movie, I will say.
It was fun because of Joseph.
He was the commentary that we needed throughout the film. I think in a film that is this ridiculous, where it's all just shenanigans. So, for example, you mentioned a teacher that is the love interest of the main girl, but then also the vampire.
Eddie?
That could be right.
I don't know.
It's a lot of almost Three Stooge kind of behavior, gimmicks and gags that are happening. And those will happen. And then it'll pan to, like, the grandmother coming to suck the blood and life out of someone to raise him up as a vampire. Pan to Joseph, who's like, yo, the vampire is out here and she's killing people. And then the main character is like, no, she's not. I have parties to go to.
I want to know if this was like a style of film that was just popular at the time, because it also felt like a Dr. Goldfoot movie in some ways.
It did.
Because, except I will say that, like, Dr. Goldfoot, first off, is more of an icon by himself. Yeah. I would watch a whole movie of just Vincent Price's different characters, quite frankly. Vincent Price's love interest. We've already seen him act next to himself. So, you know.
He could definitely do it. This movie was, yeah, it's difficult because the most iconic character wasn't the lead character.
Close, though. Like, I'm wondering if he got more screen time. Well, I wonder, the thing is, she had to get more screen time because she was two characters. But even then, did he actually get slightly more screen time than both of them? I don't know. I mean, it's the same person, but both of them.
I would say he had the most character arc of everybody.
He did. And he was the most likable. Oh, like, yeah. I didn't like anybody else except for him. And yeah. It's because you sympathize with him. And, like, it just, the struggle is real. Poor guy. I felt so badly for him. But
he was really trying.
He was also insane. I mean, not insane. He was great. But I think it's more amusing because the way he tried to solve the problems were not logical by any means. It was like, mm-hmm. I'm going to throw on a knight head thing and just go with the giant stake and confront the vampire. And that was the plan. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know.
He was oftentimes dressed like Abraham Lincoln while he was trying to solve problems, which I thought was very interesting.
He was the best character, though. What would we rate this?
8. I think it could be a 9 if the ending had like 3 or 4 more minutes and actually like made sense.
I think for me it's a 7.5. Just because I remember things I've like rated as 8 or 9s, and I can't really mm-hmm. see that on par with those. But it was still good. It was really enjoyable. The ending's a little sloppy.
Very sloppy.
But I wonder if that's just a thing of the time. I mean, it's not a thing of the time period because I'm sure there are movies with great endings. But I keep thinking back to some of these movies that we've seen. They just have like the worst. Like, I remember like the Vincent Price murder mystery movie that we watched.
House on Haunted Hill. That's where I was going.
Stop. Okay. No. So I remember that movie. Yeah. That immediately came to my mind just now.
Same. That movie, I will say, that movie's ending was worse. Because that movie's ending undid the entire plot of the movie.
Wasn't it like that he was the guy?
No, the plot was like, we're not going to know until, I don't know, midnight or something, who's the person. And the movie ends at like 9:30 and the door closes and it's like, what?
I don't know, but we found out who it was. It was Vincent Price scaring them.
Yeah, but the point of the movie was that it was like you would learn everything by a certain point. And like, because the whole thing, it was more than just a Vincent Price was the person. You had to stay alive for the whole night. And the movie ends and we're nowhere near the end of the night. And not all the characters are dead.
That's true. And I remember it was really frustrating because the way they ended it, they just panned out of the castle.
Oh my God.
And that was it.
They got like a dolly or something and they rolled the camera out the door and shut the door. And that was the end of the movie. That ending was so infuriating because the first 80% of that movie was so good. It was such a good movie.
I mean, it had us. Like, we were like, oh my God. I'm like invested. And then I the switch for me was then they took out the skeleton. Oh, and it was God. Just like Vincent Price, like marionetting like the skeleton and an acid. And it was just what is this movie?
I was honestly still here for it until they undid the entire point of the movie.
I was a little freaked out by it. Like, it was doing its job of being like a kind of creepy, eerie movie. But then just the weird skeleton thing and then just like them finishing so quickly. And also it was infuriating because I remember they took there's like guns or something. They took everybody's weapons. Why did they not just all stay in one room?
Yeah.
Because then they go split off into separate rooms. Like, that was weird to me, but it was a good movie until the end. Felt a lot like this movie.
This movie was just like, oh crap, we have all these vampires still at a house party and we have 6 minutes left. And in 6 minutes, we're going to have them all drive back in their cars, but also we're going to ship the vampire woman to Hollywood. And then the love interest is going to be with the teacher, who I guess they're both going back to live in the castle in Transylvania, is my understanding. Like, all that happened. It was not even established with dialogue what they were doing at the end. It was just like pan to airplane of crate Hollywood, pan to airport scene of woman running towards teacher and Joseph, and then they run away happily and you're like, well,
yeah,
that's what we think the ending is.
I don't know though, like, because this is interesting and we should do this sometime. I would be interested to see where we rank certain ratings or like separate ratings, like certain movie endings, like good, bad, or just confusing, because I feel like I can't recall movies that we genuinely liked the ending to.
One of them that was really good was the one that we watched recently,
Who Slew Auntie Rue?
Yeah, that ending was
good. That was not good, that was creepy.
But it did its job.
But the thing is, we don't know the intent. Was that the intent?
Regardless, it still like made sense. For example, if the House of Haunted Hill, that kind of ending were applied to this movie, it would be like, they're all at the house party. And then we're in the middle of the house party and the two women meet, and then it just pans out. Movie over. And then maybe a caption that says, were any of them vampires?
What did they give us captions on House of Haunted Hill? Like, weird captions at the end? Because the one that, you know, the really confusing one is that Manos always has the end question mark. I'm like, what does that mean?
They thought they were doing sequels.
But this movie had a weird ending. It wasn't weird. It was just kind of confusing. You don't really know what happens. I mean, you do, but you don't. It's kind of like Dr. Goldfoot in The Girl Bombs, where he's just in Russia. But then I have questions, because if she's a Hollywood actress, star, but she can't be in the sunlight, like, how is that going to work?
I mean, maybe they can be in the sunlight. They were driving home. That's the part that I did not understand.
Well, then why were they panicking? Do they all just have appointments and we're like, we got to get going?
They're busybodies. They have things to do, people to see. Parties to go to.
Oh my gosh. But it was, I would say watch it. Watch it with a friend.
The Vampire Happening, it's on Prime right now. So go check it out. But I guess now we can enter our final segment, This or That.
Okay, Jeremy, what's our This or That for this week?
Okay. I mean, this is something that you have a new experience with, so I'll be curious to hear. Computers, specifically Mac OS on your computer versus PC.
Which do I prefer?
Mm-hmm.
That depends on what I'm doing. So in terms of productivity, I think I like having a PC to do things on because I'm so much more focused. I will say I hate the Mac keyboards.
Really? Interesting.
Because I always grew up with like those like really thick keyboards that make like a lot of sound. I feel like I type really loudly and aggressively. You cannot aggressive type on a Mac. So like half the time, I feel like I'm not hitting keys, or I'm like grazing keys and it's hitting it anyway. And it also just doesn't feel like my words have power behind them. I really enjoy feeling the button going all the way down, knowing that I'm pressing this key. And then the Mac is just like, you're barely moving your hands. And I'm like, I'm not getting all the aggression out on this keyboard that I need to be getting. That's my rant about Mac. I don't know. Do you have like a preference?
Keyboards. I'm fine with a Mac keyboard. I don't know what my Mac is decently old at this point. I don't know what the new keyboards are like, if they've changed the tactility of the keys. I have no idea. I'm not that particular about keyboards, other than I just don't like crammed keyboards. But I do like how clean the Mac OS is. And I like that there's connection between my phone and my computer. So if a message comes in, I'm not near my phone, but I am near my computer and I can see it and respond, which is good.
I'm going to assume that you respond faster than I do.
In general, yeah.
Like, I don't think that the thing is, I don't think that like me having a MacBook has increased the time of me responding to people.
Oh, interesting.
I think I have something where I really don't enjoy seeing like my message and phone app a lot. And then I'll just check it and I'll have like messages from people and then I'll respond. That makes me sound bad. Editing Jeremy, take it out.
that doesn't make you sound bad. Some people don't want to be like constantly replying to messages as they come in. I'm that way about email. There are so many emails I don't reply to.
Yeah. Oh, email, I have like 3,000. But I will say though that like the really annoying thing, and please somebody comment if you know how to fix this. Somebody help me. Like, I have the focus on my phone, and I always did, and it never showed up to anybody. Right? Like, I could text people, they wouldn't know it's on Do Not Disturb. Now they can see that. And the thing is, I've gone into settings and turned it off so that it's not shared in my messages app, and it still shows up. And so people are now texting me like, why is your phone always on Do Not Disturb? And I'm just like, it's always been that way. You just haven't known.
I feel like it has always been that way though, because I've made jokes about you being on Do Not Disturb for many years now.
So you could see the little thing at the bottom being like,
yeah, with like the moon.
Yeah, but like constantly for years. Really? Because nobody else, everybody else said that they cannot see that until recently.
No, I mean, I think it's always been there. Maybe those jokes have been going around for a long time. So
yeah, but that's just because I like don't reply fast. I didn't know people could like physically see the Do Not Disturb thing.
Yeah, people can see it.
It's interesting though. Like, I'm trying to get better at it.
Why? What does that mean?
I'll go like... You know, just answering people in a timely manner is important.
I don't feel like you should feel the need to respond to people ASAP for everything if you don't want to.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Yeah,
I agree.
For sure. That's why I got an Apple Watch, actually.
Yeah, I will say your whole thing about like not wanting messages on anything but your phone is quite the claim. You're further into the Apple ecosystem than I think anybody I know, or you're definitely in there. It's on your hand. It's on your phone. It's on your computer. Like, your messages are everywhere.
The funny thing is my messages are everywhere and on Do Not Disturb. Like, and I think that's also, I think, something that's really amusing to people. It's like, you have a MacBook, an iPhone, and an Apple Watch, and you're somehow still missing my calls and texts. And it's like, I know you're going to voicemail, but it's not an insult. I didn't set up a voicemail message being like, if you're getting this message, new phone, who dis? It's like, yeah. No. I admit, I don't have that many. I mean, I have an Apple Watch and a MacBook. Like, the Apple Watch was an interesting buy for me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Difficult. Yeah. Like, I think you respond better to people. Do you respond pretty quickly to friends?
I don't like having a lot of text messages queued. It bothers me. So I'll at least read them usually. Like, email, I don't care.
Queued as in, like, it's just a notification that showed up?
Yeah, like, I don't like having the number or the red dot near my phone or my messages. Because I'm like, who did I miss the call from or who did I miss the message from?
I don't have a problem with that.
You would think it would apply to email, too, but, like, it really doesn't.
Email I put in, like, a subcategory of my phone, so it's, like, hidden. So it's not until I click on it that it's like, Gmail, you have 5,000 messages, and on MSN, you have 10,000. I'm like, like, great. And then I click on it, it's like all like Sephora or something. Right. And I'm like, well, how am I going to go through this? Although I will say, I recently started going through my email and deleting things. I'm down to 3,000.
Wow.
Great for me. I've had to delete a lot of stuff. So I was still getting stuff from, like, I had emails in there that I didn't even know I had.
And I will say the one thing I definitely don't like about all the Apple ecosystem stuff is iCloud is the most annoying thing. It is so annoying.
It's so irritating. I still have that little red dot in my settings being like,
yeah,
it's your iCloud's full. And I'm just like, because you gave me 5 gigs.
I feel dumb because I was like, I'll use my Apple email address. Not super smart because it's also backed on this iCloud bullshit. To where it's like, well, if you don't eliminate some of your storage, you won't be able to use your email anymore. And I'm like, well, this is something.
I don't use your Apple. I never do.
I
literally don't. Because I like MSN too. I'm like, I have Outlook. That's all I've used. I don't want to learn the whole new Apple, whatever, which is why I'm glad on the MacBook. I can just have my like MSN one as my main one. But like, I don't know. The way some things are set on Apple, I don't like that they have this new weird freeform app that they just automatically downloaded after the new whatever. I don't know what it does.
It doesn't do anything. It's useless. It is literally absolutely nothing. It is nothing. Yeah.
So is the home. The home one is irritating too, because they accidentally keep clicking on it. And I'm like, no, I do not need this.
I feel like home is only useful if you dive so deep into the ecosystem, like your house is an Apple device.
Like, can you imagine?
No.
That would be so wild.
It's like the people that have these Amazon Echoes around their house. You could not pay me.
Oh my gosh. We got an Amazon Echo as a present one time and we set it up and then we just immediately, like, my mom and I didn't like it. So we just immediately just unplugged it and put it away because we don't like it. But I have, like, I know a lot of people who use it daily, like tasks, just like, hey, Alexa, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me what the weather is, or dim the lights. And I'm just like, no, thank you. No. I don't like the whole AI thing. Honestly, we should have done an episode on AI because I have a lot to say about that also, because AI is creepy and there's a lot of new creepy AI coming out. The audacity, imagine if, like, ChatGPT was a thing when you were in high school doing Socratic seminars.
Oh my God. It's really, I really don't love the idea that it can just write papers for people.
No. And like Turnitin, like Turnitin.com is now checking for, I don't know how they're doing that though. I don't know how successful they've been. They claim that they can tell if your paper is written by that. But I'm like, imagine if we grew up in the time throughout high school when that was a possibility to do papers, to do Socratic seminar questions, everything via an AI. People would be doing that. It's basically like a custom Spark Notes for people.
It's scary. It's like, what does the future of work look like? Who does that replace?
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, AI doing basically everything, designing things, doing things for you, basically. And then also you have like the weird side of AI that's like the Snapchat AI that's been like really controversial recently, where it's been like saying that it can't see certain things, but then describing the certain things it says that it cannot see. That's weird. Ask, like, knowing your location, but then saying that it cannot know your location because it doesn't have that information. I'm glad I was not one of those people that fell into Snapchat. I did for like a week and I was like, this is dumb. And
I've never downloaded it. I don't understand the appeal.
I mean, maybe when I was in middle school, I could understand the appeal. But now it's like, I'm not responding to iMessage. You think I'm going to go into Snapchat and be like, let me take a picture.
And it's going to disappear.
Right? I mean, you know.
I don't get it.
Kind of insane.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to talk about it at some point, but probably a different episode. Yeah, anything to plug?
Our Instagram at Everything Is Tine. Mm-hmm. Our YouTube at Everything Is Tine. Yeah, we're back into YouTube again.
Follow us there and listen to episodes that you haven't yet. And yeah, thanks for listening to this all the way through. Hopefully it was worth it.
I love that's the note we're ending on. Hopefully we're worth it.
Yeah. Maybe it's Maybelline. Well, have a good week, everybody, and we'll talk to you later.